Our goal for the rest of the course is to calculate this primordial spectrum by quantizing, you know, by finding quantum fluctuations during produced in inflation. And so for that, we need to quantize the scalar field plus gravity together. And of course, this can be approximated by a climb to Mount Everest. And so yesterday, we set up a base camp. So we are over here. We made it to the mountain. I'm hoping to get today to camp number one, but then we have 2, 3, 4. We'll be going up and down, you know, practicing for our final climb. And then hopefully on Friday, we will calculate the spectrum here. And as I said, all the details are in the homework if you are interested, but I will not go through them in the lecture, nor you will in the homework if you are here and know it. Okay? So we started with the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. This is just normal harmonic oscillator, but now the frequency depends on time. And in principle, it's an arbitrary function. So this is our Lagrangian. So now what you do is that you write down the classical equations of motion, and then you expand the classical solution in terms of the basis. And so I showed you yesterday that the basis can be written as if you have one solution which satisfies FF equals to 1 with respect to that scalar product, then the other independent solution is F star. So this is just an expansion of the second order differential equation in terms of two solutions. And so that's the most general solution. And so the symplectic product, well, the scalar product which I define here is not really scalar, but it's symplectic product. It's antisymmetric. And by the way, what I forgot to write yesterday is this extra I. So that extra I is needed so that this scalar product matches the scalar product I'll introduce today. So this extra I should be there. Okay, and so this is all classical. These are just the constants multiplying the solutions. But of course, if you quantize this, then everything becomes an operator. And then you can introduce the vacuum. So we have the so this thing will be an annihilation operator. This guy will be a creation operator. And then the vacuum is simply annihilated by these guys. So you can introduce the vacuum. And then you can introduce the excited states as we done yesterday. So for example, n particle states by acting n times by the creation operator. And then you have the particle number operator, which is simply AF dagger AF. And that counts how many particles you have in that given state. So this was for the given chosen basis given by this function, by this solution F. But you can also choose a different basis. And that's a source of many nice phenomena. So choosing a different basis, for example, G, you can relate the two bases. So this is again a solution. And so you can expand it in terms of the first basis. You just treat it as any solution and just write it in terms of the old basis, F star of T. But now your coefficients here are called Bogoliubov coefficients. And so I showed you that as long as this coefficient beta is actually non-trivial, then the observers connected with the basis F and the observer connected with the basis G, they not necessarily agree on what the vacuum is, if it's empty or not. So if you start this with the vacuum, which is empty for F, but you ask how many G particles are there, and so we derive this beautiful formula. It's just given by beta square. OK, so as long as beta is non-trivial, then this will be a non-trivial result. And what it actually means is that particles are ambiguous. Okay, and so there's no reality in having a particle or not having a particle. So that's not a real thing. The real thing is the hidden in fields and in fields, but not in the interpretation of the fields, whether you see a particle or not. And so this may be not that familiar, because typically people just consider Minkowski space and they just consider inertial observers and connected by Lorentz transformation, and they actually do agree on the number of particles. But in curve space, or if you consider general coordinate transformations, as we will today by discussing ANU effect, yes, you don't agree on the number of particles you see. Okay, are there any questions to this? So now there is a natural question to ask. So we define the vacuum as something which was annihilated by our annihilation operator AF. But of course, you would also like that the vacuum is like the lowest energy state, right? And so everything else is excited above the vacuum. So the question is the vacuum as we define it the lowest energy state? So in other words, I'm asking, is it an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with the smallest possible eigenvalue? So for that, we need to calculate what the Hamiltonian is. So it's PQ dot minus L. That's the Legendre transformation. So P is just Q dot, actually. So here, P is Q dot. So anyway, if you plug it in, you find what you have to is just the conserved energy if omega is constant. Well, this will be just the conserved energy if t omega were t independent, but because it's t dependent, this is now again a function of time, and so it's not really conserved. Okay. So now, this is the formula for Hamiltonian. Let me write it in terms of these creation and annihilation operators. Okay, so we have it's equal to 1/2. So now P, because P is Q dot, then this is AF F dot plus AF dagger F star dot square. And then plus 1/2 omega square, and then Q is AF F plus AF dagger F star square. Okay, and so now you can split it into many terms. So there's many terms. There's always terms like AF, AF, and then AF, AF dagger, and then AF dagger, and all these terms are there. So let me collect them. So first the terms with AF and AF, so they come from here, and they come from here. So the whole thing is 1/2, and then F dot square coming from this guy, plus omega square F square, and that's the term AF, AF. Now, let's say AF dagger and AF dagger, that comes from this term and that term. So plus plus F dot square, F dot star square, plus omega square F star square. And that's AF dagger, AF dagger. Why do I have no star? It probably doesn't matter. And then you have the max terms. And so you have f dot square plus omega square f square. And then this is af, af bigger plus af bigger af. Okay, so we have all these three possibilities. And then now I'm puzzled why I have f dot square there. Let me just write whatever I have in the notes, and let's hope it's correct. Omega square f. It cannot be correct. Well, anyway, this is what I have in the notes, so let's hope it's fine. So we have af, af terms, af dagger terms, and then these mixed terms. So now let me act with this Hamiltonian on the vacuum state. And so the question is it true that if you act on the vacuum, vacuum is the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian? So not necessarily the lowest energy state, but at least some state, which is the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So now you see that the first term, if you act on 0f, just gives you 0. And that term, if you act on the vacuum, gives you 0. But this term gives you simply this thing. And this term is really, really bad because now you have two particle state, right? So let me write it. 2h acting on 0f, just not to drag that 1/2. And then you have this f dot square. Plus omega square, af dagger, acting on the vacuum. And plus the other term is this one here, which is f dot square plus omega square times 0 vacuum. And the other terms are 0 because we annihilated the vacuum. Okay? So this is what it is. So now you see that if I call this guy lambda, then this will be true. However, the first term is spoiling our feast. Right? So we actually have to kill the first term. Okay? So have to have this guy has to be equal to 0. Otherwise, actually, it cannot be true that it's an eigenstate. So if I take the square root of that, so we have f dot square plus omega square f square is equal to 0. If you take square root of that, so then you have f dot is plus minus I omega f. And so that's the solution of the first thing, so that we have the first term actually vanishes. At the same time, we still have to have a solution of our classical equations of motion. But we still have to have that f square, f double dot, plus omega square f is equal to 0. That's our equation of motion. Is the equation of motion. So this still must be true. Okay, so now let me combine these two equations. So I better differentiate this guy here once more. So I have f double dot and equals to plus minus I. Now omega depends on time as well. So I have omega dot f plus omega f dot. And then for the f dot term, I plug in this plus minus I omega f again. Okay, so this is plus minus I omega dot f is just the first term, and then plus minus I omega f dot, but that's another I omega f. So this is minus omega square and f minus coming from I square. Okay, so this must be true. I just differentiated the first equation and used it again here to plug for f dot. So now if you look at this thing here, the left-hand side plus this term is precisely the equation of motion. Okay, so what it implies is that actually, if the equation of motion has to be satisfied, that is actually zero, so this term has to be zero as well. So you conclude that from here, omega dot actually has to be equal to zero. So only in the case when the frequency omega is a constant, which does not depend on time, then only in that case, the vacuum is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so if that is so, so if omega equals to constant, then of course you can integrate this equation. So yeah, this is your equation. And that's given by the exponential as you know it. So in that case, f of t, the basis is 1 over 2 omega e to minus I omega t. So this guy is just to have normalization ff equals to 1. And this is just comes from the integration. And I have chosen the minus sign to call this a positive frequency wave. Of course, you have also the negative frequency wave with the plus. But anyway, so this is the basis if omega equals to constant. But only in this case, when omega equals to constant, you know, this is a reasonable solution. And moreover, in that case, this will be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And of course, it makes sense, because now if omega is independent of time, then your Lagrangian is independent of time. And so you have time translation symmetry. And if you have time translation symmetry, then actually you have the corresponding conserved quantities, and omega will be the corresponding conserved quantity. And then, in that case, you can write the preferred basis of states. Okay, does this make sense? Oh, by the way, this also justifies why we could, you know, whenever we separate the Klein-Gordon equation or Hamilton-Jacobi equation in curved space, you can only write an ansatz e to minus I omega t when you have the corresponding Killing vector, when t is the corresponding coordinate to the Killing vector dt. Stuff like that. If you don't have that Killing vector, then you cannot write it in terms of the exponential. All right. So that's almost bad. So now let us discuss something which is quite nice in and out states. So in general, we have this omega, which is a general function of t. But it often happens that, so this is my omega and this is t, that if you go very, very far away in the past, omega is constant, and you call it omega in. And then if you go to infinite future, omega is again constant, and let's call it omega out. And then, you know, in between something crazy happens. But after that crazy happens, you become constant. Okay. So now you define the corresponding in and out modes. So consider solutions of your equations of motion, and these are valid for all t. So you construct f in, which will be a solution of equations of motion for all the times, but you require an extra condition, let's say initial condition, that in mode is such a solution for all t, which satisfies that as you go in the past, so limit t goes to minus infinity, of f in t, and it goes as this constant frequency solution as the basis omega in. So this is given by 1 over 2 omega in e to minus I omega in times t. Okay, so you will call such a mode, such a solution, in-mode solution, if in the infinite past, it's given by this simple thing here. But so it's solution for any time. And correspondingly, the out mode is again solution for all the times, but now limit t goes to plus infinity f out of t is 1 over square root of t omega out, and then e minus I omega out times t. Okay. So now, because you have both of these are solutions for all the times, you can think about them as two independent bases. Like we had the basis f and g. So now one basis is f in, and the other basis is f out. And so you can write f out to be a linear combination of the basis f in whatever we are doing with f and g before. So again, these are the Bogoliubov. But here, the term of S matrix is maybe more common. Because what we are really describing here is something like a scattering problem, right? So we send a particle, which looks like one particle, let's say electron in the infinite past, and then in the infinite future, we have something else, and you know, and then the scattering happens in the middle. But yeah, so this is like a scattering problem, really. And so that's why these coefficients and are related to the S matrix. All right. So now it's obvious that if I start in the vacuum from whatever we discussed before, so if you start in the vacuum, which is in vacuum, which is empty in the past, empty in the past. In other words, if you consider an, so I expand my in mode in terms of a and a diggers as always, and I consider that an annihilates this this vacuum in the past. But because this thing behaves nicely in the past, it's really a nice vacuum to start with. Okay. So then you are interested in how many particles you produced by this strange thing happening in the middle. And so we are interested in, in future, we have n particles, which I still have the state zero in, so that's my empty vacuum, but now I calculate how many particles in this other basis out I have. And of course, this is still equal to beta square because it's nothing else than what we discussed before. And so this is, if you want, a particle creation. By time dependent frequency, by time dependent Hamiltonian or whatever. Okay. Does it make sense? So you may also be interested in the fluctuations of the field. So fluctuations described by, you know, endpoint correlation functions. Well, we'll be interested mostly in two-point correlation function. So correlation functions. And so again, I'll start in my in vacuum, and then I'll put lots of these Qs in it. And what you do is that you plug for your Qs, your expansion in terms of A and A Rigger. So it's obvious that if, for example, I have only one of them, so what do I get? What do I get? Zero. So remember, this is A and A Rigger term. But of course, if A is annihilated by this guy, and A Rigger is annihilated by that guy, so that's why it's zero. So in cosmology, because it's Gaussian and everything, so on, so you are interested in the two-point correlation function. Which is sometimes called variance. And it really describes the size of fluctuations of the field. Size of fluctuations. Okay, and so let's zero in. And then I have to plug it twice there. So it's A in, F in, plus A out, F out, and square A Rigger. So, sorry, doesn't make any sense what I'm writing. A in Rigger, F in star. So now you expand that again, and you have terms A and A, which are gone. And then you have A Rigger and A Rigger terms, which are gone. So the only term which actually survives is A Rigger, A Rigger term. And if you want A Rigger term, that's F in star. Okay, so it's no surprise that this is just given by F in square. Okay, so these are the fluctuations of the field in any time. But of course, we are typically interested only in the fluctuations in the future, like after everything settles down. So then you can take the limit. It goes to infinity, and you will get the variance of the field, and it's typically non-zero. So your star is, yeah, your star is somewhere here, and then later on, the variance is actually non-trivial. Okay, so this is all theory and quantum mechanics, but now with time-dependent potentials. Let us have a very, very simple example of particle creation. And you can actually calculate it yourself, go through all the steps, which I'll omit here. And this is in the setup of this still harmonic oscillator. But you can as well just work on your tutorial on Friday, where we'll do much more complicated example of particle creation by the cosmological expansion. So there will be QFT example. Here we are doing just quantum mechanics example. Okay, so example. But I think it's quite nice. And maybe it illustrates these concepts, what's going on. So we'll consider simply omega, which is just the step function. So we have omega in all the way up to time equal to zero. And then we have omega out, which is different from omega in. And you know, the only time dependence happens at t equal to zero. So our omega t, if you want, is just omega in and theta function, and then omega out theta of t. So this guy is zero if it's negative, and it's one if it's positive, the argument. Okay, so this is our potential. Okay, so now you want to solve, you know, so eventually you want to find, let's say, the number of particles produced by this potential. And for that, you need to find beta. So it's given by this beta square. But of course, you also need to identify, so in order to calculate this beta, oh, I didn't repeat that, but it's somehow related by scalar products of these two guys. So beta is given by, I can take here the scalar product. So if you take, for example, alpha, so it's f in, f out, scalar product. And beta will be this minus sign and this f star. So beta is minus f in star, f out. Okay, so this is, you just take that equation, you scalar product it with f in or f in star, and use the properties of the scalar product. So we need to find f in and we need to find f out. Okay, so let's start this f in. So first of all, we know that in the infinite past, by definition of its in mode, it has to behave nicely as the exponential as we know it. Okay, so in the infinite past, this must be true. T omega in e minus I omega in times t. However, nothing is happening in the infinite past through finite past until t equal to zero. So this will be, the solution will be true all the way up to t equal to zero. Okay, so there'll be theta of minus t because this solution is fine all the way up to zero. Okay, so now in for t bigger than zero, my omega is constant again. And I have two solutions. I have plus I omega out t and minus I omega out t, the exponentials. And in principle, both of them are possible. So I take their linear combination. Okay, so plus 1 over square root t omega out. And then a times e minus I omega out times t plus some another coefficient e plus I omega out times t. Okay, and so this is f in, and it must have this form, right? So I'm making a linear combination of two bases in that time. Okay, so now you know that f in is still a classical solution of your equations of motion. So it's a second-order differential equation. So in order this to be well-defined, f in has to be continuous, and its first derivative has to be continuous, as you know from quantum mechanics. Okay, so f in and f dot in have to be continuous. So in particular, this must be true at t equal to zero. So they are continuous everywhere else, but at t equal to zero, I get some conditions out of this. And you get two equations. And there's no surprise that two equations fix your two constants a and b. Okay. So once you impose this, and I had to do it by Maple, because differentiating, you know, exponentials is very complicated. But also you get, of course, Dirac delta functions, but the Dirac delta functions from differentiating theta. But as you do limit from left or from right, the Dirac delta function is zero, so it doesn't contribute. So really, the theta functions are all that contributes. So anyway, it fixes what A and B are. And we find that from here, A is given by 1 over 2 times omega in, omega out, and then omega in plus omega out. And B is almost the same thing. Omega in, omega out. But now there's one sign different. It's omega out minus omega in. Okay, so this comes from this imposing the continuity at t equal to 0. So similarly, you can do the f out. So you know that f out has to behave like out mode at an infinite future. So it has to behave like 1 over t omega out e minus I omega out times t. And this is true for any time which is bigger than 0, in particular infinite future. And then again, you have a combination of two solutions on the left-hand side. So c e minus I omega in times t, and then another coefficient d e plus I omega in times t. Okay, so that's your solution. And again, you have to impose that this is continuous and the derivative is continuous at t equal to 0. And that fixes c and d. And what you find that this is also equal to c. And then this is equal to minus d. Okay, so now we have two solutions. We have f in and we have f out. And then we can calculate these scalar products, f in and f out, if you want alpha, and if you want beta, which is what we want for particle production, you just calculate f in star and f out and take a minus sign. And so from here, you find that n out, and you start in the in vacuum, which is beta square. And it's okay, I didn't say what alpha and beta are. Let me say it. So alpha is omega in plus omega out divided by 2 times square root omega in, omega out. And beta is the same thing, but it's a minus sign. Omega in minus omega out, and 2 times omega in, omega out. Okay, I'm just, you know, giving you the results of the calculation. Just do it yourself. Maybe you did already while I'm trying here. But anyway, so this is that. So now this beta square, of course, is just omega in minus omega out square, and then 4 omega in, omega out. So as a first check, of course, if omega in equals to omega out, nothing has happened, and we shouldn't produce any particles. And yeah, that at least works. But notice an interesting thing is that if I actually increase the potential like this, or if I actually decrease it like that, as long as the difference is the same, then actually you create the same number of particles. I don't quite understand why, but you know, think about it and tell me why this is so. Okay, so this is the number of particles. And of course, you can also calculate this fluctuations, qt square in mode. And this is given by f in square. And I give you that formula there. In particular, you are interested, you know, what the variation is in the infinite future. So if I go t goes to plus infinity and t goes to plus infinity here, you get some, you know, some expression, omega in square plus omega out square plus omega out square minus omega in square times cosine 2t omega out, and then divided by 4 omega in omega out square. Hopefully that's correct. So that's what happens with the variation. So now, if you have omega in equals to omega out, then this term is gone. And these are just the same terms. And interestingly, you get something like 1 over 2 omega. Okay, so the variation in the infinite future, even if nothing happens, is just 1 over 2 omega. The variation is non-trivial, but the particle production is zero if the frequencies do not change. Okay, so I think this is a very, you know, instructive example how to calculate these problems. And that really you can get some particle production if you start changing your frequency. Are there any questions to this?
F in, F out, there's no theta function for the things in brackets.
Oh, of course. Oh, thanks. That's very good. They are supposed to be there, right? So this is valid for theta for t bigger than zero, and the other one is valid for, this is for theta minus t for t smaller than zero. Thanks for that. Any other mistakes you can see? All right, so now I have maybe 15 minutes. So this was all at the level of quantum mechanics. So now let me tell you very briefly what happens if you just generalize this to field theory. And I'll be very vague and I'll do it in, I don't know, 10 minutes. So QFT in Kerr space and so what I will assume that actually the way we are building things here is that we'll split our space-time into some time equal to constant slice, so into time and the space. Okay, so split space-time into time t and spatial coordinates describing my space x. So in other words, I have the whole space time space, and I'll say I'm sort of choosing some, you know, t equal to constant slice. So this is t equal to constant slice, which better be my Cauchy surface for the data and stuff like that. And the coordinates x actually live on that surface. And this is how the time elapses. So there's a normal to that surface, which is dt over, it's how the time goes. And this is my spatial slice, sigma. Okay, so now, what you will do is that you split now instead of q of t, you consider a scalar field phi, which is a function f of x and t. Okay, so phi is a function of x and t. So this is the scalar field. And I'll pretend that t is normal t and x is normal x. So I'll just write it in the momentum space. So I'll write it as d3 of k. Of course, this cannot be done. This is not a covariant expression I'm writing here, but doesn't matter. Phi k of x and t, and then ak dagger phi k star of x and t. So now if you just forget the integration over k, this is like what we have. We split it, the solution. So this is the classical solution of field equations. And we split it into a times one basis and a dagger times the f star basis. So this is the f star, this is the f. But now we actually integrate over k because, so for each x, we are basically splitting as we did before. And so as before, f wasn't really the basis e to the I omega t, but it was some general basis. So here, again, because you have curved space, this is some complicated basis. Of course, if you were in Minkowski space, you could just choose this phi k to be I omega t minus kx, I kx or whatever. So specifically, you know, just to recall, in Minkowski, we would choose phi k to be something like e to k dot x minus omega t. But this, in general, cannot be done. And in general, you have some very, very complicated basis, phi k. OK, so we have split it like that. So now you want to define a scalar product again. So if you have solution 1 and solution 2, then this is the stupid I, which may actually causes that other I. And then you integrate over the space. So this is an integral over the surface sigma over the t equal to constant slice. And if you want to write it coherently, there's a corresponding determinant, of course, so that this is actually nice. And then you have the direction, which is the dt direction. And then you have phi 1 star d mu phi 2, and then minus d mu phi 1 star and phi 2. OK, this is the covariant expression for the scalar product. So now if I choose n mu to be really dt, then this thing here will just pick up. So it will be 1, 0, 0, 0. N mu is 1, 0, 0, 0. So this thing is just dt, right? And so I have phi 1 star dt phi 2 and whatever. So you start recognizing whatever we are writing before, the symplectic product for the oscillator. OK. And you can really show that this thing reduces to that thing if you have proper ansatz for phi, namely that phi is like q of t times a spatial part. OK. So that's the scalar product. So now you want to normalize the solutions here with respect to the scalar product. So before we have f, we had ff equal to 1. So now 1 is, of course, the delta function. So this is what you want. And so that's one solution. So then you can quantize as we did before. So now the other thing is that the interesting thing happened when we changed the basis, when we went from f to basis g, right? So now you define, and so this is done the other way around. I don't know why. So this is my old basis. And then I write it in terms of these Bogoliubov. So and this is my new basis. So I have one solution, phi k, and then I have another solution, phi bar l. And so these are simply connected by this alpha times and beta times the other one, right? But again, because I'm the field, I integrate over the momentum space. And so these coefficients alpha and beta, as before, are given by the scalar product of phi and phi bar. So beta KL is just given minus phi L star, and then phi K scalar product, and alpha KL equals to phi L phi K bar. The same scalar product, although one bracket is this one and the other one is that one. Okay, so notice here that these Bogoliubov coefficients now depend on K and L, so on two different momenta. So in some sense, you are able to connect, you are able to change the K vector K. So as before, you know, we had alpha and beta, and it could in principle depend on one frequency and another frequency because the frequency was changing, right? So the frequency. So here in curve space, and for the field, because the x coordinates are not necessarily Killing coordinates again, you can change the corresponding Killing k vector as well. So that's why these betas in general depend on two. They can change the k vector from k to L. Of course, if you have, if x is a Killing coordinate, then these beta kl will be proportional to delta kl. You will not be able to change the wave vector. Okay, and so finally, the number of particles of a given wave number k, you start, let's say, in the vacuum given by the solution phi, and then you calculate the number of particles in the bar. And what else it would be is beta square, but now beta depends on two things, but left hand side depends only on k, so I have to integrate over L again. D3L beta KL square. Okay, so this is the number of particles as seen by the other observer. So is this something, you know, French, or is it, you know, very, very small generalization of what we've done before, or very, very small generalization, maybe. So, you know, you just do everything as you did before. You just add some integrals over the momenta. And yeah, that's basically what you do.
This bar notation?
Sorry. So star is for complex conjugation. Okay. So I'm considering that phi and phi star are two independent fields. So now I change. So before I had f and g. Mm-hmm. So maybe I should have written like phi and psi. Mm-hmm. But instead of psi, I'm writing phi bar, like a new.
So why wouldn't
here? So f is phi, and g is phi bar.
Why wouldn't beta be phi l bar phi k? From the definition of phi k.
So you have this thing here. So you have phi k. Oh no, why are you saying this is something strange? So beta, I have to multiply this thing by phi bar.
L.
Right? So I'm multiplying phi bar with phi k.
So it should be the other way around? About
yeah, maybe. Okay. Very good. So is that correct or is there a mistake?
You have that in your notes.
Huh?
That's in your notes, that form.
This one?
Yep, that's correct.
Fine.
In your notes, it's the same.
Okay. Yeah, but all you are doing is you are taking the scalar product of that of that thing. Oh no. So maybe I'll. Okay, I'll just tell you in 2 minutes what Hawking, what ANU effect is. So you can apply all this machinery to some very, very trivial example. And the trivial example is that you just consider the Minkowski space, but you look at the Minkowski space from two different points of view. One of them is from the inertial observer point of view, and the other one is from the uniformly accelerated observer point of view. And what you actually find out is that the uniformly accelerated observer doesn't see the Minkowski vacuum as vacuum, but rather he sees it as a thermal bath of a given temperature. Okay, so the picture, so ANU effect. So this is your Minkowski space. You have x and t. And this is a trajectory of an accelerated observer. So this is an accelerated observer. Of course, this accelerated observer has two horizons associated with him. So is this future horizon and the past horizon. And this accelerated observer connects with himself, coordinates t-bar and x-bar. So you better this t-bar and x-bar be such that x-bar equals to 0. So if you are sitting on you know, the accelerated thing, on the accelerated rocket, you have x-bar equal to 0. And then t-bar will be your proper time. So that's the meaning of the coordinates. Okay, and t-bar for the accelerated observer is the proper time there. So the connection of these two coordinates, the Minkowski ones, and the accelerated one, so this t is the Minkowski, is 1 over a e ax bar sine h a t bar, and then x is 1 over a e a x bar cosine h a t bar, where a is just the magnitude of the constant acceleration. Okay, so if the observer is moving with the constant acceleration a, then this is the connection of the two coordinate systems, the Minkowski one t and x, and this accelerated observer t and t-bar and x-bar. Okay, so now, interestingly, the metric, if you use these coordinate transformations, so the metric is just conformally rescaled Minkowski metric. So in one case, this is the case, I'm just doing it in two dimensions. So these are the Minkowski coordinates. And in the other coordinates is precisely the exponential. Okay, so this is the only difference is that now you have the conformal factor in front of the other metric. So now if you consider massless scalar field, so lambda square phi equals to 0, because it's massless, the scale field, the scale factor in front of the other metric doesn't play any role, right? And you have the same equation. You have wave operator is simply just dt square minus plus dx square acting on phi equals to 0 in the Minkowski case, but it will be the same in the accelerated case plus dx bar square on phi to 0. Okay, so you have exactly the same wave equation, and because this is you have exactly the same wave equation, then the phi actually can be written as the standard exponential as you know it, kx minus omega t. It looks very flat, right? And then phi, so this is phi k, and then phi k bar will be the same thing, is the same solution of the same equation, but now with bar things. So it's e to I k x bar minus omega z bar. Okay, so now we have the modes. We have phi and we have phi bar. And all we have to do is to calculate their scale product to calculate the beta. Okay? And so the number of particles as seen. So we start in the Minkowski vacuum. And then we consider this thing here, Minkowski vacuum bar. And it's an integral from 0 to infinity dl beta al square. This is what we established. So now beta is just given by the scalar product of this phi k and phi k bar. But of course, you have to calculate in the same coordinates. So you really have to do the coordinate transformation from x to x bar and from t to t bar. And that's quite complicated. Okay. So this integral, so this thing is something complicated. And the integral is complicated. Okay. So this thing is complicated. And many authors, actually, when they discuss Unruh effect, they avoid doing this integral. But for example, if you want to see all bloody details, look in Mukanov's book. If you want to see a nice trick, which still takes like 3 pages to actually explain, look at Carol's book on general relativity. So anyway, so what you find if you do that integral, or if you do the bloody trick, that this is 2 pi k over a minus 1. A is this acceleration of the observer, right? So the number of particles with a given k is given by 1 over 2 pi k over a minus 1. So now if you look at this thing here, this is nothing else than Bose-Einstein distribution with the temperature given by a over 2 pi. So t given by a over 2 pi. And so this is the famous Unruh effect. It's like the accelerated observer sees the Minkowski vacuum as thermal bath with a temperature given by the acceleration divided by 2 pi. So actually, if you accelerate sufficiently fast, well, if the you zoom really, then you can cook things by this acceleration. So let me stop here. Are there any questions? All right.